separate what you so glibly call poetry or law or religion or talk, then at the layer of speech which we try to unearth and which should make you feel that the people of primitive stature have done something for us, which in this moment in us is dying and in great danger, therefore, of making us into the blonde beast of Mr. Nietzsche or of the concentration camps of what is it called in Vakutka in Siberia, that this is what is dying in you, gentlemen, the power to speak originally, and not glibly, and not just talk, and not just listen to these cliches. Your inability to say anything unusual or original, that can only be overcome if you recapture the sense of the first layer of speech, the creative layer, in which the same word, gentlemen, is religious, legal, poetical, and familiar. It's one and the same word that has all these capacities. If words mean to pave roads, to blaze trails through time, then it shouldn't be too difficult for you to compare these actions of speech to what you all know as trailblazing. That much the Boy Scouts you have done yourself. But only you are, of course, as little pagans, limited to space. It's one thing to blaze a trail in a wood, gentlemen. It's a very different thing of blazing a trail into centuries. That's what the Indians have done, these red men. But you cannot do. You cannot think over the next 24 hours, practically. Perhaps for the next 3 years when you say you have to finish college. All the rest, gentlemen, for you is in the lap of the gods. And you, if you die, you have done nothing ever to extend anything over the moment. You have become impotent with regard to speech. And you even say you are non-committal, you won't stick your neck out, you will never say anything that you cannot restore. You begin every sentence, I may be wrong, but... Now, gentlemen, if a tribesman had always begun all his sentences with this silly remark, I may be wrong, which is always hiding your arrogance and your conviction that you are right, they would never achieve anything. A man's word is a man's word. It isn't helped by always, like a salesman, I mean, just to get, reconciling and soothing over all the ladies in the kitchen so that you can find your fuller brushes. Now, this is an essential for to understand that as long as nothing else was created and man began his career on this earth, every word had the connotation of being a religious utterance because it was inspired. And a man was tied to his word. And the very word religion means that the word remained the power over him. I have called his ancestor my ancestor. Once an Indian, always an Indian. That's why these people could, because of this tie back to what they had said. That's the original meaning of religio, gentlemen. To bind back. But to what? To what I myself have said or have been called. If you are called an American, in primitive times, there was no way of getting out of it. You were, as long as you spoke and invoked the name of these tribal heroes, you were that what had been said over you. Once, you didn't even have to say to yourself, once this name, as it is called in the old scriptures, was called out over your head, if you were standing over it, and you were tied back, the word respect, gentlemen, and the word religion, therefore means that you have to look back, respect, you see, that to which you have been tied. So perhaps you put it down in this manner that respect is the subjective response to religio. And religio is the objective fact that some name has tied your future back to this state. You will perhaps now understand why for such an Indian or such a wild man it was perfectly normal to cry out the name of his tribe until he was killed by the arrows of his the enemies at the pyre. You all have played, I suppose, as children and have been a little bit tortured by your enemies who try to get you to cry or to give in or to lament and to show signs of weakness. Well, it is very hard for you to understand why this event or that happened at every war path among the Mohawk here, the Five Nations or wherever this goes on, everywhere in Africa the same today, that it was a part of the war waged. Could the name be shaken off this follower of this name? Would he deny, you see, his religion? That's why they tortured these people, and that's why it was the pride of the warrior that he wouldn't renege, you see, that he could not be forced to lament or to cry. He would laugh at and scorn his enemies to the bitter end to show that he respected this immersion, gentlemen, from animal, from beastliness. For the primitive man, gentlemen, of course, the abyss between him and the animal was much more to be emphasized than you like to admit. For you, he is nearly akin to an animal. And you see, they are cavemen, they are primitive, not much more than an animal, just another animal. For him, of course, he was already as far as you in his own self-consciousness. He had found ways of identifying himself with a whole eon, with thousands of years, with a long time to come, with his grandchildren, with his descendants. That gave him the glory which no animal has, life everlasting. He was responsible for life's return on earth. That's a man's religion. You have no religion if you think of yourself. Pietism is not a religion. To be pious, I mean, to think of your own salvation. A man who thinks of his own salvation has no religion. The condition of thinking of salvation is that you save others, and the primitive man wanted to save his descendants. He wanted to become their ancestor. This ridiculous personal Christianity and personal religion that's going around here on this campus, gentlemen, that's no religion whatsoever. God is not interested in single souls. He's interested whether man finds his path into the whole of his creation. And God didn't create millions of men. Don't be betrayed. He created us as a unit. And anybody who thinks that he has a private religion, gentlemen, has denied religion. Religion is public. All religion is more public law than the Constitution of the United States. It is the most publicized, the most cosmic, the most celestial, the most universal fact of your existence, that you are God's creature. That's not a private conviction. And of course, it was a very sensible way in this country to murder religion by declaring it a private business. If you declare religion to be a private affair, gentlemen, it has ceased to exist. And that's why you have no religion, because you think it is a private affair. It's only your own business. That's no religion, that's a philosophy, that's a thought, that's an opinion, that's a whim. It has nothing to do with religion. Religion is your acknowledgement publicly that you stand under a tradition which you cannot break without reneging on your humanity. And your willingness to die at the stake for this, which for every tribesman did. But you don't mustn't take this torture at the warpath as something purely political or purely legal. It's religious. The spirits of the tribe demand it. So we get first the mixture in every word a tribesman invokes or evokes. It's a mixture of religio and respect. The religio propelling him to follow out what has been said, and the respect, of course, his response looking back to this whole and acknowledging it. If you could recover, gentlemen, the correspondence of respect and religio. You would perhaps know what reverence is. Reverence is this immersion into this twofold atmosphere of respect and religion. You have no reverence. And that's your poverty. People who have to call old people boys or folks have no reverence. And this is a great lack in this country, as you know. Without reverence, there is no recreation. Because reverence is the feeling that at this moment God is creating the universe. And how can you create yourself without reverence? Reverence is the atmosphere created by the constant electricity from the totem pole to the descendants and from the descendants to the totem pole. We revere and for this we are revered. You have here in this whole realm, you see, you have this double stream of two influences constantly strengthening each other. You must think of language, gentlemen, as a higher power of electricity. Perhaps that comes nearest to the fact. As long as you think of mind and think that words are instruments of thinking or expressing what you think, you are stupid. Because you don't think unless you first let the words which you have learned come to life in you. Don't believe, I have not still to find in the darkness who can think. You have all a wrong relation to your language. Instead of being satisfied that the great words of Shakespeare and the Bible can come to resound in you and come to life in you, you have the real idea that you think and then you express what you think. And that's why what you think is so stupid. Do you think that it won't take you first about 30 years to rethink all the great thoughts that have been thought? You won't even make an attempt. So you never reach the state of being thinking. And so you always preface your words rightly. I'm a little, you see, foggy, and you are very foggy, you see. And you are a little uncertain, and you are quite unsure. Sure. Of course you're unsure. Right, gentlemen, for which this cause is given, and all my causes have been given, is that man begins spiritual and mentally with himself. You cannot. You see, begin in an atmosphere of reverence because people who love you look upon you, your parents, the citizenry of this country who give you this chance here of being students here, and you pay them back by respect. And in this constant give and take of your the religion which is making you, pushing you forward and hoping for you, waiting for you to fulfill what we need. You have an office in this community, gentlemen. You have no right to think of yourself. If you try to think of yourself, you cease to think. Thinking is a public action. Religion is a public action. This is not private, out of your private affairs. There is no privacy in the creation of the universe, gentlemen. Where has God created you as a private being? This is your illusion. And you live as illusionists, you call this idealists, with the head in the fog, because you believe that your thoughts are your personal affair. Gentlemen, the thoughts which are in your head, they are the most universal traditions of the human race. They have somehow reached you in some shadowy way. Through words, through traditions, through opposition which you have made to other, has been arousing you against others. If you contradict somebody, don't you think that this is more than an electric repercussion, so to speak, or a recalcitrancy of your material against some truth that is hitting on your wall and knocking there? Would you call resistance that is fed into the electric stream, would you call this original thought? Is resistance not completely dependent on the electric power that is sent in? Resistance may enhance the current, you see, but it isn't itself anything. Now, the only thing you do offer, and you really offer it, is resistance. You offer resistance to thought. And that can be very fruitful, because the longer you resist, the higher the voltage may go, by which finally then in you there is a transformation of the electric current.
something very much to be desired. This is to be learned from the tribes. The second thing, gentlemen, is every word is legal. That is, if this reverence is changed into irreverence, the word that has been spoken declares that something has gone wrong. The opposite direction, of course, is the crime. If I invoke the name of the ancestor and he has left behind a certain order in which the various clans know how to marry and how to mingle, who is whose cousin and who is whose brother and who is whose sister, if peace has been streams and irradiates from this living relation between the dead who speak through the person of the mass bearing medicine man and the living. When this power is weakened, some of these boys will become a straggler. He'll go astray. He'll break loose instead of going, as the language says, astray. Righteousness and straight line means continuation of from the past. That is effect of the word and names first spoken. If you break this away from the righteous path, here you break outside the tribe, you break the community. Every violation, gentlemen, of the continuity between ancestors and descendants in an old group is immediately slated to meet with a violent reaction of excommunication and expiation. What is excommunication? Very simple. This man who has murdered a brother of the tribe, you see, or his own brother perhaps, Cain and Abel, the Bible says it very simply, has to leave. So that's a curse that's spoken over him in the Old Testament, in Genesis. Cain must err around the world. He has lost his home, his belonging, his membership in the tribe. So here you see the limitations of the group. The group has to eliminate, to excommunicate anybody who breaks the law. And that is the meaning today still in the Catholic Church of excommunication. And in excommunication from the Church, you can study the original meaning of all punishment. All punishment was a violent convulsion, reversion of the group against a splinter, a wrong body, a somebody who didn't belong. I mean, who showed by his actions that his reverence was not effective, that respect and religion did not keep him in line, as we say. All these words are perfectly literally. Keep in line means in the line of descendancy, in the line of progress, in the line of tradition. So, gentlemen, the most universal punishment is excommunication. What you have today, capital punishment and prison and probation and reformatory houses, are all pure second thoughts about punishment. The first radical punishment of any community is exclusion, sending him into the wilderness. The scapegoat is then the... Well, I'll come to this a little later. Excommunication is very important for us at this moment, gentlemen, because the excommunicant, the excommunicado, is the founder of the next tribe. The hundred thousands of tribal languages, gentlemen, which have been created, mean that a man who was sent out into the jungle or into the bush, who had left his community because of some deviation, just as from the party line, exactly as if the communists talk the same way again. They are primitive groups who have no answer except excommunication from the party line. Now, you see, Tito makes up his own branch and creates a new brand of communism. because he can no longer swear by the words of his religion. Now, Tito is a very good example, gentlemen, of the ramifications of new political groups in antiquity. You must think that every year in ancient days, 5000 BC, a new tribe would be created by somebody who would not stick by the totem of his tribe and would not repeat the sing-songs, so to speak, of the tribal dances at the proper time, and therefore would be held incommunicado and had to leave in a great hurry, perhaps stealing one of his nice girls in the neighborhood so that he can found a family and a tribe of his own. There have been innumerable tribes, and every tribe had to speak its own language because the essence of the tribe is the same language. And therefore, the ancient layer of tradition, gentlemen, when irreverence breaks in, is a new speech must be created. I must have new totems. I must have you make a new beginning. Any so-called werewolf, you may have heard of this strange word in the Nazi times, the werewolf. That's a man wolf. A man who becomes a wolf again, who enters the bush. That is the origin of all the Indian tribes in this country. That is the excommunicado, the man who is thrown out. And many of the languages, if you study the Indian languages in this country, can see that they are inventions, that they are invented in contrast to the language from which the man, you see, had lost the membership. Language was membership. Therefore, where membership ceases, a new language is necessary. Antiquity was haunted by this pluralism, by this necessity of innovating constantly the ties of loyalty. You can see that in the original unity of religion and law and poetry and familiarity, a word could no longer make the rounds between a man who had lost his old totem pole and the people who still stuck to it. The break in the tribe is the speech itself, the language. If the totem is not effective, and if the tribe feels that somebody has gone astray, the result is that the man becomes his own ancestor, has to pull himself out like Münchhausen by his own bootstraps. That is, he has to start from scratch. In the story of Oedipus, you have a real story. It's not the Oedipus complex of Mr. Freud, gentlemen. There is no complex in this. But in this, that he is a man without ancestors. He doesn't know who he is. And he begins, therefore, a new career. Innumerable languages must have been created. As we have businesses springing up every month in this country and they register, so you must think that all over the earth, the lawless ones, the people who had broken away from the law of the jungle, had to begin from scratch. Innumerable people, of course, perished, were unable, you see, impotent to have such a new offspring and such a new line of descendants, but innumerable also succeeded. And if we have today traces of perhaps 100,000 languages on this earth, you can see what effort went into the making of them. And we have no reason, I at least don't see any reason, to find a contradiction in the incredible number of languages and in the fact that the origin of language is identical. That is, men spoke from that moment on where he remembered his dead. Where the dead, where through the mass of the medicine men, remained alive. That is language everywhere. But the inner weakness of our human race, of course, consists that we can break the law. And it breaks constantly. You break it every night. Just ask your janitor. And so if you see how many laws are broken by you, and me, by the way, too, then you can imagine that at a time when every break of the law seemed fatal, you see, that at such a time a new grouping was necessary. What we can say then, gentlemen, as a distinction between us and those tribesmen is that any break of the law in those days was fatal. That is, it ended the effectiveness of the tribe for certain members. We live, by the grace of God, you see, in a much more elastic society. We think it will never break. You forgive the tenfold murderer and embrace him and think he can be improved. He cannot be improved, but we feed him to the rest of his days and he is pardoned and we all love him dearly and forget all the 9 people killed in the process. This the ancients could not afford. The law there had no elasticity. Once the law was broken, the men had to leave. That's very definite. So we come here to a very important point in our relation to antiquity. We will never be able to go back to the austerity of the ancients. They had no way out. Once one left the narrow and straight path of righteousness, this tribe had no room for this member. And therefore, you get the whole story of mankind as this tremendous profusion of political groups. To this day, we are haunted by the diversity of speech and by the manifoldness of the ways of men. But don't be betrayed. If you had lived in those days, you would have to be equally harsh. Because the question of survival came first, and the only way in which this group could make headway and survive to this day is, of course, that the law meant to be kept, held. So we can learn from them the ferocity or the austerity or the majesty, is perhaps the best word, of the law. That is the reason. You have no reverence, gentlemen, because you don't fear. You don't revere. You break the law 1,000 times and you think the governor will pardon you. And there will always be some lobby which will say, forgive this man. Now, the ancients, gentlemen, had to think the other way around. How do we save the community? Every one break could jeopardize the whole existence of any grouping. This you do not feel. You have never the idea that it is in your power to destroy the church and the state. Gentlemen, I'm afraid to say it is in your power. It is in your power. Although you do deny it, gentlemen, every one of you can destroy the church and every one of you can destroy the church. It is state. Very effectively. Just as you can destroy the family. You can. But you have this illusion that you are just a human being, that nothing depends on you, and what can happen? The mighty United States and you little person, you can do what you please, you can waste your time, eat up your substance, learn nothing, cut classes, get drunk, pet girls, whatnot. It doesn't make a difference. Gentlemen, the old tribes were very far from this illusion. They had much greater ideas of men. They thought that any one human being as seated here in this class was able to affect the community like explosive dynamite. You can destroy this community, gentlemen, every one of you. And you do it because you don't know that you can do it. That's so tragic. That you are all ruined. At this moment, the liberal arts colleges in this country are destroying themselves. Because they think, after all, that they are playgrounds and nothing serious can happen. As soon as you think this, gentlemen, you can always say, know that civilization perishes. As soon as people think that they aren't destructive and that it doesn't matter what they do and that, after all, you are superfluous and what does it matter what you do? As soon as you think this, gentlemen, the whole order of society is over with. It's played out. And that is happening under your noses in these United States at this moment. Because you are all convinced that after all it makes absolutely no difference for the whole of society whether you break the law or not. A law-abiding citizen is not a man who doesn't want to be found out, gentlemen. A law-abiding citizen is a citizen who has such reverence for the law that he must speak of it day and night and make converts to the law. As in the first psalm. That's the content of all the 150 psalms, gentlemen, that we must testify to the law of the Lord. otherwise it cannot grow. How does the first psalm begin? Yeah, go on. And speakers of the law of the Lord day and night. He is like a tree planted at the rivers of water. This then, gentlemen, we can learn from our confrontation with antiquity, gentlemen. The tremendous risk where you think it doesn't matter. They felt every one step matter was final. So what would now the community have to do after the werewolf or the excommunicate had left the tribe? They would have to expiate, they would have to purify, they would have to exorcise this terrible pollution of the purity of their tradition. And therefore I put here as one line, gentlemen, the way out. And as a proper line which emphasizes the continuation, the way of expiation. It's an important word, gentlemen, because it contains two elements, punishment and repentance. You don't understand repentance, mostly. To you it's, again, a pietistic thing of private salvation. Gentlemen, God is not interested in your repentance for private reasons, for your pleasure or for your rebuilding. The community, God's mankind, can only find the right path by reasserting what is right. What is expiation, gentlemen? After a murderer has left the group and has gone taken to the bush, this old group must reassert the law. And therefore, we come now to the first building of the tribe after the funeral. It belongs to every funeral that there is a grave. By the grave, the people in the churchyard with more than one grave. Now we have the same story in front of us when we speak of the altar. The word altar is not very popular today. Most people think it is a lecture table or something. The word altar, unfortunately, has fallen on evil days. We are all Unitarians today and think that the church consists of pious words. Gentlemen, the altar is the center of a church because our wrongs have to be expiated. Those who have left the church are not present at the altar. They have left it. And in this country, most people have left it. The few who stay there want to reassert the way of righteousness with the help of the altar by instituting, for example, the Last Supper, which is using the altar for the reinstitution of the origin of the group, of the Christian fellowship. It is something very simple, gentlemen, but something of tremendous importance, because today we are inclined to forget about the murder and say, well, I didn't commit it. The dentist committed it in Cleveland. So what's this my business? That's why you have no criminal law that commands any respect in the rest of the world. You think it's the business for the governor of pardoning a criminal. That's the whole problem. Or writing a detective story and showing how the perfect crime can be committed. Gentlemen, that's not of any interest. As long as people are so stupid of reading detective stories, they are lower than the animals. And a detective story to me is an unworthy occupation. And I'll tell you why. Because in any real crime, the problem is the restoration of the right way. You think, of course, the right way exists always and it cannot be broken by a crime. But I assure you, when this boy in Mississippi, what was this boy's name? When he was murdered, it is Mississippi that needs expiation, you see, and the murderer needs punishment. There are two things that have to be considered in any crime. The community itself must become conscious of the right way. And that is the altar's meaning in any community, gentlemen. Whether you call it altar, I don't care. The altar is the place to redirect the group, which may otherwise say this exceptional crime is normal. In Mississippi, we still don't know why not every white man may think that every black boy of 14 can be murdered without consequence. They haven't said so. They haven't expiated the crime. We have mixed this, gentlemen, because we have a prosecuting attorney. We have an attorney general who prosecutes cases. The public prosecutor, gentlemen, mixes in our case, you see, private vengeance and public expiation. Why do we insist that the crime must be persecuted, you see? Because we feel this man affirms his public agent for you and me that we think this was wrong. So that it isn't just an act of private vengeance when somebody who has lost his child by kidnapping goes to the police and asks, you see, vindictively for some restitution. You and I have appointed a public agent who speaks for you and me and reasserts what is right. But you have forgotten this. To you, that's just all expediency, gentlemen. And that's why this society is so very flimsy and so very unreal. This country doesn't know that it is polluted by crime. Polluted. We are all dirty because of Mississippi, gentlemen. I'm ashamed of having to call Mississippi a state and the people in Mississippi my co-nationals. It is shameful. It's a scandal. I have nothing to do with these people, but I don't do anything about it. So I'm in the same, I'm with them. I have no right to declaim here anything if I do not admit that I am ashamed because I am guilty with these people. I cannot shake this off. We haven't sent soldiers there. We haven't sent the militia there. We haven't, the federal government hasn't intervened. So I haven't done anything. You haven't done even less. You haven't even gotten excited because, for heaven's sake, don't be carried away. Don't get excited. I mean, it's not your business. Oh, no. If you do go on like this, as you all do, I don't care, and why should I care? You will look so dirty in the eyes of the world, gentlemen, that no daily bath will wash this off from you. Dirty, you are. Expiation means an attempt for cleanliness. And you are very concerned about the cleanliness of your body, gentlemen, but you are not at all interested in the cleanliness of your mind and your soul. And this is so unclean in this country, so dirty, that I don't give anything for the hygiene of your body, gentlemen. A little more dirt around your skin wouldn't do any harm. You care for the wrong kind of cleanliness. It's all a question of the of soap, or what's Gamble and Procter and Gamble, yeah? For you. You mean really that purity and cleanliness is the same? The ancients didn't think so. They thought that purity was something quite different from cleanliness. You've confused two things. The real problem of purity is to have an open path into the future. How, gentlemen, how can you, if the old path is beset by murder and theft, kidnapping, lying, stealing, rape, everything? You have no future, gentlemen, if you do not clean the path of your group, that certain things cannot happen. You remember the famous book title, It Can't Happen Here. That's exactly what I mean by purity. Since you have all lost this sense, gentlemen, of the relation of religion and law, you become lawyers and think that's a way of winning cases. Gentlemen, that's not a lawyer. A lawyer is somebody who restores on his end the purity of the community. That's why a good lawyer will always be in politics. Because politics is a way, of course, of helping the law, if it is a real lawyer. But you mistake this, gentlemen. This is a terrible prejudice that a lawyer is a man who wins cases. He shouldn't win in unjust cases. He should only win the right cases. Of course, even a criminal must have a lawyer, but this is not the business of a lawyer of making an unjust man win his case. So this is the relation of religion and the law. Now we come to two other aspects.
If you want to keep the people within the boundaries of the tribe by the religion, by invoking the names of the totem on the totem pole, and by putting yourself into the shoes of the ancestor, which was at that time literally done. They put a young baby into the shoe of the ancestor, you see, so that he might always walk in the straight line of the ancestral spirits. When we say put yourself in the shoes of somebody, we just follow the old custom, still verbatim.
So when they did this, gentlemen, they had, of course, to bring the greatest emotional pressure on the people to keep this law. Now, what is the greatest temptation, gentlemen, to go out of line? You know it very well. It's sex. The passion for the women will make you forget your father's rules and your mother's example. And all young men at all times are, of course, rebels because of the women. They are made into rebels by women. Jealousy is the good reason for crime. From jealousy, the first murder has sprung. The Bible is very nice about Cain and Abel. It's jealousy for the love of God, which makes Cain kill Abel. You remember? The woman is eliminated in the Bible, as in the whole Genesis. And instead, the love of God is put in its place. Well, it's the same feeling. Jealousy is the incentive for a young man. You call it competition. I call it jealousy. I mean, competition is exactly always based on jealousy. And jealousy is the accompaniment of love. Jealousy is the negative side to love. He who is not jealous doesn't love. That's why most of you are only kind, because you aren't jealous. Kindness has no jealousy with it. Real love is fantastically jealous. God is jealous because he loves you. He's not kind. You are kind, you don't love, so you need not be jealous. If a man invites three competitors to his wife's bedroom, he may be very kind, but he's not jealous, and he doesn't love both. The complete confusion again in this country, as between cleanliness and purity, gentlemen, you mistake today kindness and love. The complete confusion again in this country, as between cleanliness and purity, gentlemen, you mistake today kindness and love. Love and jealousy are two sides of the same thing. You can purify love and you can purify jealousy, but they still are integral parts of reality, gentlemen. A man who doesn't want to hold what he has or would not hold anything, he would be hollow. I mean, if you have something in your hand, you have to close this hand and you cannot open it or it will fall out. That is, therefore, jealousy is a very serious business. It is never talked about in this country. There's many talks of insecurity and all these things between children and parents, gentlemen. I find the great passion that rules the world is jealousy. It's a negative passion. Most acts are committed from jealousy. I don't know why this isn't so interesting. It always intrigued me. How to pattern jealousy that is ennobled. But first it has to be admitted that it exists. In this country, jealousy just doesn't exist. I have nowhere seen so impertinently jealous people as in this country, because they don't know that it exists. So women in this country, when their husband has a friend, a male friend, just a spiritual friend, any relation to anything higher the jealousy of the women by which they try to snuff out this light which burns in, the, in their husband's heart or mind is incredible. They have the infamy of declaring that outside there should be no passion for truth or glory or anything. He has only to love this little woman. Watch out, gentlemen. That's where you break down. Your marriages are all ruined by the jealousy. And it's not a jealousy of sex, gentlemen. It's a jealousy for anything that enters your life as a power. All these women are absolutely ridiculously jealous. And it is never mentioned that they are. They take it for granted that this is necessary. Or that they haven't even the word for their own vice. Find out before you marry whether you can convince your wife that she must give room for your noblest passion. And I mean by this truth, or think of Martin Arrowsmith, who has read the book. You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
Hey, do you?
Yeah, we are.
Well, his interest in for real research, for real science, and the respect needed for this, you see. This is a religious situation, you see. And most women do not want to share the religion of their husband. They want the husband to share their religion. They all want to convert you. And no other gods except they themselves. It's very serious, gentlemen. You must fight for your own religion when you try to be in love. You must speak about what is highest in you to your wife. And you must make a convert of her, or she will make a convert of you, and you will be so small, like a little toad. Let's have a break here. To revere their community, the unity in which they live, poetry is doing something. Not in your case. You think poetry is doggerous. You think poetry is something, again, something private. Gentlemen, without poetry, a nation cannot live. As long as you have no American poetry, you have to play Shakespeare and to read English lyrics. And if you make all American poets into college professors, you will never get poetry. A poet is a wild man, gentlemen. In Ireland, the poets were the judges because they were high in politics. To you, poetry again is something perfectly impotent, silly, and it's next to inebriation. But the inebriation, gentlemen, by liquor, by spirits, by spiritual drinks, is an imitation of the power of the holy frenzy of the poet. Because what does a poet? Gentlemen? He draws men and women together in holy enthusiasm. And what we call poetry today is, of course, so terribly isolated, but all the dances in the tribe and all the songs are of a poetical nature, and you can today classify them as literature, or as poetry, or as artistic, or as aesthetic. Unfortunately, that's all done. We have books on primitive art, where, of course, the misnomer, they were not ethics, and they didn't buy pictures. They didn't have cameras for photography, and they didn't have Life magazine. So then poetry, gentlemen, was the power of drawing the descendants of the dead as the living in harmony and love together. It was the bridal song of the universe. It was the Midsummer Night Dream. If you look at the Midsummer Night Dream of Shakespeare, you have an idea what really poetry is. It is, what is the Midsummer Night's Dream? The Midsummer Night's Dream is a wedding poem. It was intoned, it was enacted, it was performed, it was sung in 1595 at a wedding in, not in Windsor Castle, but one of the other big castles around London. Now I've forgotten which castle it was. But it was in a royal palace where people very close to the Queen got married. The daughter of the Earl of Oxford, and her next of kin, the Earl of Derby. And for this wedding, the Midsummer Night Dream was just thrown out like a necklace of diamonds, you see, to poeticize the event. And it's a wedding gown, around the souls of men so that they can orient themselves and be drawn together, not in a rape and not in a seduction and not in an elopement, but in a public merriment and marriage. Gentlemen, we are so wicked and we are so passionate and we are so jealous and we are so easily deviating from the law that poetry is assuaging us. It is the domestication of the wild animal men. Well, of course, you are so mild-mannered and so dispassionate and so absolutely indifferent to life that you don't need poetry. So poetry is only for dangerous people, gentlemen. That is for people who know that they are dangerous and need the more Orphean power of music. Of course, poetry is music and music is poetry. You separate the two and think that music and poetry cannot be separated. Today, the more you separate them, the more you forget that they are the same thing. What is music, gentlemen? Your own power to become redundant with sound, to become sonorous. If you find sound inside of you, you are musical. And you should lead a musical life. Most of you don't even know what that is. But we are full of music. The man who has not music in himself, who says that?
Shakespeare.
Where?
Merchant Venice.
Where do I quote this? I have an idea that this is an assignment.
The man who has no music is not going to be trusted.
Yes, and where, what is the assignment? Which, what did you have to read in this course? What are the assignments? Please. Oh, help me. He's illiterate. And it's the most beautiful paper I've ever written. It is musical. Has none of you read Time Bettering Days? Well, isn't there something to be said about the Merchant of Venice? And yet, do I not quote at the end this whole great dialogue? I mean, this night, seven times. Does nobody remember this? Well, that's preceded directly with this famous song, "The Man Who Has Music in Himself." Oh. Now, gentlemen, we come to, however, to a real law. Gentlemen, the political grouping of mankind takes it upon himself to put love under death. To put love under death. You know perhaps that there is a famous place in the Old Testament that love is as strong as death. It's in the Song of Songs. Love is as strong as death. As long as death, gentlemen, does not rule love, there is no time. Love is a passion of the moment. Sex. Now, marriage, gentlemen, is the victory of death over love, so that love will continue. That the dead will have their right. Perhaps it isn't right to say the death, but the dead. Because you can have no marriage which is not performed in the name of the spirit of the ancestors who look down from both sides, bridegroom and bride, you see, and bless this couple as following in the footsteps of righteousness and of the law. That's the essence of a marriage, that it is legal. The law can only bind if it binds back to something that has already started. Liberalism, that had no relation to the dead, would say that a free love affair is just as good as matrimony. Gentlemen, don't believe it for a minute. Your women folks want to see this wedding blessed from time immemorial with a great wedding song. You may be a barbarian and think it's nicer to elope, gentlemen, because the man has no normal relation to the past. He has to acquire it by education. But the Midsummer Night Dream, for example, is an example how poetry can create this atmosphere between old and new in which the rebel men you, because he writes the poem and shows his own creative power, so to speak, can be reconciled to transfiguring the existing order. Poetry is a means, gentlemen, of taming, not the shrew, but taming the rebel. So that's why the poet became a judge in Ireland, gentlemen. That's why you must write poetry or you are damned. And you must read poetry, gentlemen, and you must know that poetry is a power in your life, whether you call it music or you call it art or you call it poetry. Don't call it something nice. It is powerful. The distinction, gentlemen, between an Englishman and an American is that if you are alone, you turn on the radio or some noisy thing, or you go into a car and let the motor run. An Englishman will take out one line from a poem and it will feed him all day. I'm quite serious that the English nation is so great because it has a relation to poetry which no other nation I know has. Not the Germans, not the French, not the Americans, not the Russians. One line of real poetry will be the music that feeds an Englishman. The Englishman is not musical. You know, they have no composers. They are all imported like Handel. Because all their music is in their words. But what poetry they have and how they nourishes them. I assure you, one line of poetry for an Englishman is his nourishment as on an evil day. He can escape doing evil or suffering evil by quoting a line of poetry. You cannot understand this, but gentlemen, but you must learn to understand it. Because you will be very unhappy if you do not develop this power inside of you of restoring the reverence, gentlemen, of the law and of quieting your eagerness to break the law by poetry. Poetry is that, we call it civilizing or pacifying force, which reconciles your passion with the existing order. Because all poetry must try to formulate a new feeling, a new impression in an existing medium, you see. That already is a step into order. You know very well that the passion that is articulate is no longer dangerous. The inarticulate passion is terribly dangerous. And therefore, gentlemen, articulation is nothing from the dictionary, is nothing that you can write in a course. It's your own system that is vibrating in the universe. I assure you, you are all born poets, but you have destroyed it in yourself. Rediscover it. Every man is a poet in his great tension of having to live forward and having to respect the past. We have to be poets. Whether you say a grace at table or whether you sing a song, Dartmouth Undying, you see, after it has died long ago, and so on. What is it, gentlemen? It is an attempt to re-evoke the original power of the order which has civilized it. So the poetry, gentlemen, is seated in the tribe around the dancing ground of the young. And we have two great holidays that proved to me that besides the funeral day and besides the day in court and besides the sacrifice at the altar, the dancing ground sees on Valentine's Day and on Walpurgisnacht Day, on May 1st and on February 14th, an attempt to engage, this is a wonderful word, gentlemen, to engage the young in the movements of the tribe, in the rhythm of the tribe. What's an engagement? You don't know that. To get engaged is to get involved in the convolutions of the political group. Because engagement is nothing just to fall in love. It may not be anything. But you will then follow the line of peaceful descendants of the order as existed, as created. On May 1st, gentlemen, and on one, it has split. In the northern countries it was May 1st, more to the south it's February 14th. Since we have no winter in New Hampshire and Vermont, we celebrate it on February 14th. Because that's already the warm weather, obviously. We are completely perverted here. We should have May 1st as our holiday for this. Gentlemen, on these days, which are the same day originally, the young were given away by the parents in love. They would dance around the maypole, and they would select their sweetheart. And that was the engagement party for the whole tribe. That is, officially, not at that time, engagements were not private affairs. But the tribe took care of his descendants, and anybody who was marriageable, you see, would at that time, you see, try to pay to find its cover. Every pot has to find its cover. That's Valentine's Day and May 1st, and it is the oldest layer of holidays we have in the tradition of men. The funeral day depended on the real death of the hero, of the founder of the tribe. The May 1st could be universalized in the abstract in responding to the peaceful order of the descendants, you see. They found a way within themselves in which murder could be avoided, in which jealousy would not go rampant, in which everyone would be satisfied with his own girl, you see, and there would not be this wild promiscuity, you see, by which everyone would be in everybody else's way. So marriage is the recognition of the power of the dead over the living. This is very hard for you to understand. You think it's a private affair, wedding, but you must begin to wonder, why is wedding the most ceremonious affair left in America? Why do you have bridesmaids? Why do you have a man to give away the bride? Why do you have all this rigmarole? Always the same Hochzeitsmarsch, this terrible wedding march, should be forbidden by now. It's always the same. It always sounds like a funeral march. It mostly is. Really, gentlemen, have you ever thought how funny it is that you people who sit here in your shirts without a tie and without a coat, and I wonder why you don't go barefoot, that you should suddenly at a wedding adore all kind of things you do never understand, you don't even know what you're talking, the minister has to put these words in your mouth, you obediently repeat them, and why do you do this, gentlemen? Because by marriage, the living generation recognize the authority of the dead. Very simple. And that's a poetical affair. It's the opposite from the crime. To break the law means to leave the tribe. To marry means to enter the tribe. Marriage is citizenship. Marriage is emancipation. Marriage is coming of age. That's why in a tribe, initiation rites and wedding engagement all go together. The dancing ground is the place where this takes, the spot where this takes place. Every tribe, go to Olympia in Greece. Who has been there? Anybody? No guided tour yet? There you have the funeral of Pelops, and the stadium for the chariot races, and the dancing ground for the muses, already mentioned in Homer. And from there, the conjurati, the votaries, the people who have taken this vow of common Hellenism, would go out to war on the war path outside. And so we have four spots by which a tribe will organize its existence on this earth in a visible fashion. The grave, the maypole on the dancing ground, the altar for expiation of the crime with a cord around it, and the cord is only a derivation from the altar, and the war path go leading into the bush, into the jungle, into the outside world. It is very important, gentlemen, that even the little, smallest tribe already has this order of life. Connection with the past through the grave, the tomb, the mound. Connection with the future through the altar. Connection with the against the anarchy inside the covenant, the convocation, the convenience, the coming together, emphasized by the emotional poetic power, you see, of song and the muses and the dancers. The Greek word for this is orchestra. Orchestra, you abuse, gentlemen, these poor people sitting between the stage and the spectator public you call orchestra, don't you? The gentlemen, orchestra is something very beautiful. It's the center of everything. It's the dancing ground. And we have no such popular word. I have to invent it, dancing ground. But you have to learn that the grave and the altar and the dancing ground and the warpath are the four constituents of any group that has survived death, that has survived the moment, and has created an avenue through time. Without the dancing ground, there would be no Indian tribe today in this country. They would have lost their integrity, their identity, wouldn't they? And without the grave, there could be no speech, no common language, because in the name of the ancestor, the language is spoken. And without the warpath, there could be no verification of their religion, no testing. There would be anarchy. It would make no difference who was who. But it makes a difference, gentlemen, who is who. And without the dancing ground, there could be no marriage, there could be no succession, there could be no peaceful succession. Every marriage, then, there would be a rumpus, either between the generations, because the father of the bride would be jealous, you see, or because of two comrades in arms, who would, one going to Troy and the other going to Argos, and then you would have the Trojan War. And you had the Trojan War. We have forgotten all these things, and let me close with one remark, which is rather ticklish to make, but I think it's... What time is it? Oh, wonderful. I have a quarter of an hour. That's a long time. So, gentlemen, even today wars break out like the war against for Helen of Troy. This seems laughable, gentlemen. I told you already about the tribe in the Amazonas region which perishes because the people no longer respect their women. The neighbors, who are stronger, go against this very little Putian tribe, and just when they feel like it, these hunters and trappers just take one of these women. And in this way, the morality of the tribe disintegrates. And you just see that the question of the women is the question of the survival of the group. If they cannot protect their women against rape and against stealing, the society is at an end. It's as important as murder. It has to be, you see, you cannot have it. When the Russians raped all the German women in their territory in the most gruesome way, they wanted to show that there was no German nation left. That wasn't, that is the lust that is, they showed. They wanted to show that we are the victors, and there's no law. It is as brutal and as simple as this. A political order breaks down, gentlemen, when the men can be murdered and the women can be raped. And the first two laws are that a woman is safe in the community without marriage. Nobody can, you see, claim any right over her body. And a man's life is safe among brothers and comrades. He cannot be killed without remedial action, without the murderer having to leave the community. There is no room for the murderer in a group. That's why I complain bitterly about this country, because you people, young and strong and people, tolerate this. And never do I hear in politics ever anything important mentioned. What you're talking about are all the unimportant issues. What is desegregation compared to the murder in Mississippi, gentlemen? It is very easy to talk about desegregation in schools for little children. That's an escape. It's cheap. The other thing that might cost your life, that's dangerous, but that's worthwhile. These are four laws of existence, then, gentlemen. And I'm not quite sure that I... The war the Hitler and his gang waged against the existing order had very much to do with marriage problems, gentlemen. The anti-Semitism in Germany of these small artisans and little businessmen was very much a question of jealousy against the academic professions. There are innumerable songs in the German university towns about this rivalry between the people who finally married the girls in this little town and the students who had a good time with them before. And since we have this old tradition of Heidelberg and the universities, and you know a little bit of college towns, you can easily imagine that this is a tremendous rift between the so-called educated classes and the uneducated in a country where the student would marry according to his social status, you see, but would of course have a good time in his youth with the girls around. And by the way, I don't mean anything much evil, they would just dance together, kiss each other and have a good time. But jealousy, of course, aggrandized these abuses and made these people just saw red. The whole story of Hitler cannot be understood. I thought I should mention this to you. You're old enough to know such things. It's not a political problem. It's not a problem of principles or problem of theories. What was behind this word race is a very, very positive problem of jealousy. We are a real jealousy, and a jealousy which is not ununderstandable. It is a problem of who is on the marriage market, who competes. Competitors, gentlemen, competing suitors are very cruel to each other. One has to die. That's formally in the duel, you see. If you competed for a girl, you and your rival went before let the arms speak. That's the origin of the duel. This all is hushed up here. You look down on duels, for example, as something ludicrous. Gentlemen, it isn't ludicrous, a duel. It's, I think, quite a reasonable way of admitting a great passion and conquering it in some normalized way. It is better than having the Nazis kill 6 million Jews in gas chambers. So don't frown on small things like duels before you have understood them. The rivalry, perhaps that's a common word between competition and jealousy, which you may use, gentlemen. Rivalry is real. It takes all the poetic powers of any community to overcome rivalry. Poetry is the victory over rivalry. Let me repeat this once more. Then perhaps you will begin to understand why poetry is a political cement of the first order. You see, in the 19th century, we began to speak of national literatures. It didn't exist before. Milton never thought of himself as a national poet. He was a singer of God in the English tongue. But Milton still is not a national poet. But today you all have courses in American literature, haven't you? And in English literature, and in Italian literature, Professor Wood, and in French literature, of course, and in German grammar. And don't be betrayed, gentlemen. At that time, it seemed possible to overcome the rivalries within a nation with the enamel and the lubrication and the anointment of poetry. And in this sense, literature has a tremendous part in the political development of America, of France, for example. France is nothing without Balzac and Zola and Proust, you see. It is. It's a country in which these great novels bring together, and the most jealous people in the world, the English, French, of course, are, because they worship Venus, and so they also have to worship the god of jealousy. And you have neither Venus nor jealousy. You have just human kindness, gentlemen. That's a different thing. Is there any American great love story? Only the funny one, the scarlet letter, which I always thought was funny. You know the scarlet letter, yeah? I mean, the man has no idea what love is. It's, you know this, he has a scarlet letter of it. Who has read the scarlet letter, sir? What do you think of it? Is that a real story? I have to take it back. There is one great American love story, which I think is a very good story. That's Paradise by Esther Forbes. I recommend it to all of you. It's a very wonderful story. That's a great love story. Esther Forbes, she lives here, not far away from us. Paradise. It's a love story of the 17th century in Puritanical New England. It's infinitely better than the Scarlet Letter. Gentlemen, jealousy can only be overcome since it is the greatest rivalry, rift among the living, by a greater passion, a nobler passion. The whole problem, gentlemen, of life is that the ignoble passions must be overcome by the noble passions, not by the human mind. The mind never wins any victory over passions. The nobler passions must win out over the ignoble passions. The stomach can be conquered by the heart. If you just want to eat well and you fall in love, you can go hungry for a long time, I assure you. But the evil love between the sexes has to be overcome by the nobler passion, you see, of peace and law. A man may be very much in love with his fiancée. That's no reason why he shouldn't go to war when he's called. Now, you may take this very empathetically and say, I just go compelled, but why do you go? Because you feel very well that this takes first seat. The community in which you want to get married to this girl has first to be saved before you can marry inside of it. Can you see this? So I hope I have shown you, gentlemen, that the tribe is something we all have in us, and if we don't, we burst. We explode, we perish. A last word about the war path, gentlemen. The war path makes as the necessary to be undistinguishable. And that's the importance of the tattoo. In the tattoo, we say we won't deny our own group, because the tattoo is something that we cannot wipe off. We cannot camouflage, you see. We cannot behave as though we were not members of this tribe. It's our ultimate testimony. These are the tattoo is our commitment. Again, you have lost this. You don't want to be committed. You don't want to be recognized. But you are. Wherever you go, you are recognized as an American. That's your tattoo. I mean, traveling anywhere in the rest of the world, you will always be found out. And it's very pleasant to be found out as an American, except for tips. So you can be proud of your country. But the tattoo means that it is not a matter of choice whether we can be proud or not. If you are defeated, you still have the tattoo, you see. And it is still your country, your tribe, your order. The war path, then, gentlemen, is the ultimate limitation and delineation, but also the ultimate commitment of the members of the political group. And the war path makes it necessary that there is this very painful way of history through the ages. Every group starts with this limitation that it can only enthuse and incorporate, that's the right word, gentlemen, incorporate a limited number. And we haven't solved this problem. That's why you must understand that the United Nations are a blender and a blinder for you. If you think of them as a final order, they are not. They have can give you no tattoo, they can give you no poetry, they can give you no expiation, no altar, and they can give you no history, no tradition. They cannot invoke and re-evoke any spirits. Today I think the United Nations are a public danger, because they push you into this idea that your highest relations to the divine are private. And in a nation, in your own nation, they are not private. They are part and parcel of your existence. But the United Nations are such a cloak. I mean, it has nothing to do with your own body and embodiment. The incorporation of the tribe, gentlemen, is limited. And so the founders of the first tribe have made for us this tragic path necessary into many, many steps for slow growth. You always ask yourself in your mind, why all this rigmarole? Why is there English and French and German spoken? I know many abstract Americans who think, wouldn't it be much better to have just one anonymous shareholding company and everybody has a share in the whole thing and the whole globe is divided up, you see. Gentlemen, because you would not be able to enthuse and take in the next generation. All your plans about political order are so childish because you never think of the weight of the dead and of the unborn. You only think of yourself. You cannot organize the world yourself because by the time you have succeeded, there's another generation and they will want to do the opposite. The problem which I have posed before you, gentlemen, as the first order of creating speech, is the order which is powerful enough to break your own, the will of every generation. If you believe in dialectics in the sense that one generation does one thing and the next generation does another thing, you can't have any order, any law, any marriage of mine. You can only have constant rebellion. And this country has been more or less perpetual rebellion. We don't need a revolution in perpetuity as the Russians because this country has been founded and kept going by immigrants. They've all forgot always the previous generation and they all started from scratch again. And therefore it has appeared to you that you can think in politics and government as the will of the living. Politics, gentlemen, is the harmony between the will of those who have gone before us and ourselves. It is nothing else. It is never your own will. If you think of politics as your own will, you are ridiculous and you are sterile. And just as the United States have been sterile for the last 450 years, because they thought that they had to convince the electorate that we are only doing the will of the people. Gentlemen, people are many generations. You are not the people. If you don't have your ancestors in your loins and your descendants in your loins, you are only the people if you speak in the name of many generations. You are not the people. That's your illusion. That you never know. For the one moment you tell me that you are a little grain of dust on the surface of the globe, or you are you're just a human being, the next time you pose as the Democrats and say, we are the people. It is both wrong, gentlemen. You are allowed to be the people if you say nothing which you will not be religiously committed to. If you are willing to die on the battlefield, you can give a law. If you just write a statute for fraternity, that's not binding to anybody. It's not a religious business. It's a secular business. So this is the whole story today. I wanted to draw together the language of the law, the language of religion, the language of poetry, and the language of defiance, the language of martyrdom, the language of...